Welcome to ITE 1 Module 2. This module is on computer safety and tool use. So, what do you guys think might be some general rules of safety that we might follow when working with a computer? Let's try and name some.
Switching the power off?
That's a really good idea. If we don't, we could get electrocuted, or we could damage components.
I suppose we should try to discharge any static we might have on the desktop or something before we touch things.
Absolutely a great idea.
Always unplug your computers before you clean them.
Oh, yes, definitely, for sure. Okay, so along with those, here are some very common sense rules on how you cannot get injured while working on computers. Always follow national industry and workplace safety rules. Be alert and awake. A tired worker can be danger to oneself and others. So, yeah, drink the coffee. The coffee's good. Stay awake, but not too jittery. Training is essential when working with electricity, power tools, or any other potentially hazardous equipment. Use safety equipment. So, we're going to use our ESD straps. We're going to use goggles if we're working with something that might break and fly up in our face. We might use gloves if we're working with certain components. This is really important. Lift with the legs, not the back. Many back injuries are caused by people bending over to lift a heavy object. So always use the legs so that you don't throw out your back. Because if you throw out your back, you're not going to be working for quite a while. And of course, always act professionally. That has nothing to do with being injured or not. Well, I guess the client could possibly hit you. So, yeah.
That's very true. I was just going to say there are actually... I actually got a computer case once that actually came with a set of cloth gloves so that you could actually put these cloth gloves on your hands so that you wouldn't slice yourself up on the sharp edges and stuff on the inside of the computer case, which was very thoughtful of them, especially considering the... the sharp edges on this particular case were of a special brand of steel. I think it was probably similar stuff to that they make swords out of, because I'm sure you could have, you know, sliced yourself in half on this particular case. I'd like to advise students that if you are buying a case for your computer, spend a bit of money. The cheap one is going to cut you if you're not careful, and they can be really nasty. There's nothing worse than a splinter of steel in your finger. Hurts a lot.
Oh, yeah. I was always told in one of my classes that your computer isn't yours when you build it unless you've bled into it. I don't quite agree with that. It is possible to build a computer without bleeding into it. But I've never done it. So, yeah.
Electrostatic discharge.
Thank you.
Okay. Another very important safety consideration is that we should not be working with a few key components of the computer. Can anyone tell us what we shouldn't be working with?
Monitors?
CPU?
Oh, no, we can definitely work with the CPU, but the monitor is not such a good idea.
Printers?
Laser printers.
Right.
Anybody know why you shouldn't work with laser printers?
The dust that they give off?
Yeah, that's carcinogenic. There's another reason. The actual fuser drum is actually charged up to 3,000 volts. If you earth that to you, you're going to end up being a fried smudge. Also, the toner drum. Also, the fusing element gets very, very hot because it actually burns the toner onto the paper, and it would be like dropping your hand on a hot plate. Not a good idea. Leave it to qualified printer technicians, because if you don't think you know what you're doing with a laser printer, you don't. So don't.
The reason we don't work with power supplies was the third thing we should not work with. power supplies and monitors have very high amounts of electricity. So definitely don't ground yourself to a power supply or monitor if you're working with one. But really, we should probably not be working with them because the voltage is so high, you could very easily get injured.
Just for the technical people amongst us, the power supplies are a switching mode power supply. They use some high-capacity electrolytic capacitors to store and utilize to actually do the chopping up of the wave, and we won't go into how the switch mode power supply works. We could get Mr. Taylor to do a Thursday chat on that if anybody was really interested. But essentially, you have capacitors that are very highly charged. The same goes for monitors. And if you manage to empty out the charge from those capacitors, they can literally throw you across the room. And if there's a wall or some furniture in the way when you get belted across the room, you can actually do yourself some very serious injuries.
A couple notes on things not to do with anti-static bags. These are the bags that your components usually come in, and the bags you should always keep your components in, but not on. Do not put a component on the outside of an anti-static bag, because that's where all the static goes. So you're going to, or could possibly, fry your computer component. Also, don't leave an anti-static bag inside the computer. Well, don't leave anything inside of the computer, but especially not an anti-static bag, because that could cause some pretty big ESD problems for you.
Ah, I actually have a story about this. A friend of mine was testing a hard drive, and he put it on top of an anti-static bag. Now, the outside of an anti-static bag is conductive. And he turned on the computer, and he said, "This hard drive isn't spinning up." And my other friend walked over to him and said, "Yes, note all the little blue sparks that are arcing off the circuit board of that hard drive. I'd strongly suggest you turn the power off now and see if that hard drive is still all right."
So, was it?
It wasn't somebody you knew. It was Chris who actually got the CPU out with the hammer and bent the pins.
Oh, well, was the hard drive okay?
Yes, it was. It survived.
Wow, I want to know what brand that was. I want one. Okay, so some information on static discharge, electrical status. Static discharge, or ESD, at least 3,000 volts of static electricity must be built up before we can feel them. So, it's really quite a lot of static buildup before it shocks us. Anyone want to guess how much static needs to build up to hurt a computer component? Okay, I guess we don't have any takers. It's 30 volts. Only 30 volts of electricity can damage a computer component. So you can't feel the amount of static electricity that is going to damage your computer components. This is why we wear a wrist strap or put our components on an anti-static mat. Because we can't feel it. We don't know. You can't see it. You can't feel it. But your computer components could be fried. Okay, so now I believe we're going to talk about power supplies, and how to protect from power problems. Okay, there are many different types of power problems. We have a spike. A spike is usually caused by lightning, and it lasts for a few milliseconds. It's a very short upward jolt of power, and this can ruin computer equipment. Even a very short, even a millisecond burst of power can ruin computer components. We've got the power surge, which can go, you know, from 1 to 2 seconds. This is usually caused by instability in the power grid, so it's a little bit longer, and so it can also ruin your computers. Those are the two types of...
Question?
Go ahead.
Which notes are you working from? Because I'm looking at the competency-based notes, and mine look different to yours.
Same notes. I'm looking at the competency-based ones. I just jumped because I looked at number 4, and I wanted to do power so that it made sense when I talked about number 4.
Oh, good. I was just making sure that you do tell students not to plug printers into UPSs and stuff, and you come back to that, because that's very important.
No, I was going to go there, but I wanted to talk about UPSs before I went and told them not to plug the printers into the UPSs.
Fair enough. It's all good.
Just tell him to butt out.
There's a method to my madness. Something like that. I do know what I'm doing. I do. It's okay. Okay, so the spikes and surges are the type of overpowering of devices, as we'd say. Now, how about underpowering devices? You can have a brownout where your power actually goes down by, I believe it's 5% or more. And so some of your devices will work in a really strange way, you know, go slower. A tape recorder might spin slower. You know, like when your batteries are dying in your tape recorder. If you have, like, a radio plugged in, it might sound kind of like that. What? Okay.
That's okay. So anyway. That was from 5 minutes ago. He was saying he'd be scared if you didn't know what you were doing.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. Now, we all know what a blackout is, right? That's when nothing works. You have no power. And all your computers will shut down and everything will shut down. It'll be all nice. So, we've got these terrible things that can happen to your power. What can we do about it? Any ideas?
Good old battery backup. UPS? UPS?
That's right. And do you know what UPS stands for?
Uninterruptible power supply.
Yep. Uninterruptible power supply. That's one thing we can do. Any other ideas? I think most people have one of what I'm thinking of at home plugged into their computers right now.
I was just going to ask Bob, actually, have you ever had any of your gear hit by lightning?
Not computer gear, but some of my ham radio gear, but not computer gear.
Yeah, it doesn't work after that, though, does it?
Smells funny, too.
That's right. Power strip, also called a surge suppressor. And make sure that your power strips are UL listed if you live in America, because that means that they're probably pretty decent and they're not dodgy, crappy little power protectors. So make sure that's UL listed. I can't quite remember what that stands for, but they make sure that all of your electrical equipment will work as promised.
I was just going to say, not all power strips have surge suppressors in them. A lot of power strips have a 10 amp overload fuse, and some of them do have an earth leakage residual current device, or circuit breaker, or RCD as the electricians call them, but not all power strips have surge suppressors in them, especially the $2.84 ones from Kmart. They don't tend to have them in there. Sorry, you want to say something, Jenny?
Go ahead, Jenny.
When you talk about the strips, is that actually in the power supply itself?
No, that's your regular power board. Yeah, we all call them in America. They all have them, and they're called power strips, and they're all surge protectors.
Okay, now we've got a special form of dodginess over here, and not all of them have a surge suppressor in them. I've actually heard stories that because of your deregulated power grid, it's necessary to have those surge suppressors in there because you can get some pretty bad power.
They just come with it. That's just how it goes here. Even if you buy the worst, most horrible Walmart brand, it's got a surge suppressor. I've never even heard of it not being inside of one until I talk to you.
Okay, just be aware that there is a varying quality in the surge suppressors. They're only set to handle a certain number of joules of energy, and you might find that the cheapy from Walmart isn't set to handle many joules of energy, therefore it won't handle decent surges. It'll just go straight through. And to answer Mark's question, the phone jacks in the side are so that you can put surge suppression on your phone lines so that you can protect your telephony equipments from things like lightning strikes and stuff hitting your phone wires.
What do those things look like?
They look as though they've got two RJ12 jacks in them, one next to the other. One's an in and one's an out, and then they've got a surge suppressor wired in series with that. So, there's some power boards have actually got the things where you can run one little lead in and the other little lead out and then run it into your phone systems to protect them from surges.
Okay, folks, I'm going to have to catch you later. I'm going to have to disappear. Bye. Bye, all.
Bye. See you later.
I think the telephone lines are the number one conductor of lightning into homes in America. It's really important to have your phone lines grounded.
Oh, I didn't actually know that. That's pretty cool. Okay, so we have the UPS is the uninterruptible power supplies. They're always on. They're always waiting for a power surge, and they will grab your computer right away and switch you over, no problems, to the backup power. They'll probably beep at you and give you alarms and lights and all that to tell you that you are you don't have power to shut down your equipment. Some of them might even shut down your equipment for you. We've got the standby devices, the standby power supply, that's what it is. And they're on battery back, but they're not always on. They sense when a power failure has happened and they switch over, but sometimes they're not quick enough. In rare circumstances, they cannot be quick enough to save your gear, and down you go. So the UPS is the most reliable way to keep your electrical components and computer components safe. There's only one thing you should not plug into a uninterruptible power supply, and that is a printer, because two things, okay?
Monitors and printers. CRT monitors should not be plugged into UPSs because they have very big voltage spikes that will overload them, and printers should not be plugged in. Laser printers. You can plug LCD monitors into your uninterruptible power supply. However, it depends on whether you're sighted or not, because let's face it, if the monitor goes out, most blind people don't care, so you can get more runtime by not plugging your LCD into your UPS. Stuff to add on the UPSs as well, if I can.
Go for it.
There are essentially, as Grace has said, there are standby power supplies and there are uninterruptible power supplies. Uninterruptible power supplies run the load off the batteries at all times. Therefore, the load is always being drawn off the batteries, and then the batteries are charged by another circuit wired in parallel. A standby power supply actually has a relay that flicks to battery power when a drop or sag in power is detected. And as Grace has pointed out, if that doesn't happen quick enough, your devices will reset or behave erratically, although most PCs can cope with slight dips in power for a millisecond or two because they have capacitors to keep things running. There are a number of different types of UPSs. They generate their waves in different ways. You've either got a stepped sine wave, or you've got a proper sine wave, or you've just got a square wave UPS, and depending on how much you pay, depends on how good the AC waveform generation is when you're on battery. We won't go into that too much, but let's just say you get what you pay for. And it's also worth mentioning that UPSs have batteries in them, usually sealed lead acid batteries. If your sealed lead acid battery becomes unsealed, you can actually end up with acid everywhere, and that's not very cool. And sometimes after time, the you can actually have batteries fail, and you will need to replace your batteries in your UPS every 2, 3, maybe 5 years. And a big comment from Mark that's saying, yes, you should probably run around and unplug everything when you're in a storm. And that is a good idea if you happen to be home. If you're not going to be home, though, it's a bit difficult to unplug everything. So I'd recommend a surge suppressor as well, in case you happen to not be at home.
Any questions on the power? Anything confusing anybody?
I have a question.
Go for it.
In the battery backups at work, there are six receptacles, and three are backed up by the battery, and three are not. Is there some way to determine which ones are and which ones aren't? Is there a standard? Are the ones with on the side where the power cord goes in, are those the three that are on the battery backup, and the three sort of off to the other side, they're not? Or is there any way to tell for sure?
Do you want to take this one?
Go ahead. I was going to say, I bet you they're colored or there's diagram or some sighty type of thing. That would be my guess, but
I
don't know.
I was just about to point out, yes, they are color-coded, and if you have a Symbian mobile phone, you can install Seeing with Sound, the voice, from www.seeingwithsound.com, and it has a free color recognizer in it. Just before we were to bemoan the fact that they were colored, you can actually tell which side is which color by using your Symbian mobile phone if you have one. Yes, three are surge protected and three are backed up. There is another easy way to tell which ones are backed up and which ones are surge protected. Plug in a non-critical load such as a radio or a light and rip the power out of the back of the UPS and see if the radio stays on. Then you'll know which side is battery backed up and which side's not. Then mark it with your labeling of choice.
Roger, roger.
Did somebody else have a question?
No, he just said true.
Okay, cool. We're going to talk a little bit about tool use. We're going to go down and talk about the types of tools to use in just a little bit. But some tips on tool... Oh, my goodness. Someone's messaging me. I'm just going to close that.
Okay, you should use the correct screwdriver. I'll just take this point, and then you can get back to this point. You need to use the correct screwdriver to remove the correct screws. Some students think that it's okay to use a flathead screwdriver to remove a Phillips head screw. Yes, well, it usually works once until you've burred the top out of the screw, and then you can't get the screw out, and then you've literally got to drill the screws out, and that is not very cool. Don't do it. Do not use flathead screwdrivers with... Do not use Phillips head screwdrivers with Torx screws, or you'll burr the top out of the Torx screws and you'll never get them out as well. Use the correct screwdriver for the correct screws. There's one point, I think.
Yep, that was it, and I got rid of her. So we're all good. Hey, Elise, good morning.
Okay, just looking for the key on the keyboard on this function at the moment, and hoping to give a few people a demonstration of a cavi lecture.
Cool, you've got it.
Just hang on for a tick, guys. I'll let you know when I'm ready to come back.
Yeah, that's fine. You can type something into chat or something.
Okay, while she's doing... Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, keep going.
All right, so it's... Since some tools are magnetized, you might think it's okay to use magnetized tool, but magnetic fields can be harmful to the data stored on magnetic hard drives, so don't use the magnetic tools, especially if you're blind and have a little bit of trouble with your fingers. They might slip, you might hit the wrong part of the computer, and really mess things up.
Now, whilst I agree with the sentiment of those notes, has anybody ever managed to kill something with a magnetic screwdriver? I've never managed it, and I've been working on this stuff for 20 years. But if I ask you in the test whether you should use one, no, you should never use one. But has anybody ever killed anything with a magnetic screwdriver?
No.
I've never used a magnetic screwdriver in a computer, because I think I'd be the one person that would break something.
Yeah, we're sort of saying that in our experience we've never actually murdered anything with a magnetic screwdriver, but you probably shouldn't use them, although sometimes it can be really difficult to pick screws up out of little holes and stuff when you're working on really tight spots and stuff, so...
Okay, you might think it's convenient to use a pencil to change the settings of dip switches inside the computer, but the pencil lead can be a conductor, or... it can break off inside the computer and you may not get it back again. So don't use pencils to flip switches or poke and prod at things inside of the computer.
Kieran's just pointing out the reason that they recommend not using magnetic screwdrivers is another one of the reasons would be because sometimes you get magnetic screwdrivers with a very weak magnetic tip. Somebody hasn't magnetized them properly, and the screws can actually fall off and fall into components and stuff, and then they short across a couple of capacitors or something. So A, make sure you're working on things that have been turned off, and B, it is not okay if there are screws still rattling around inside your device. Make sure you take the same number of screws out that you put back in, because eventually it's going to go rattle, rattle, and that will be the end of your device.
Yeah, that's the don't leave random things inside of your computer bit.
When you're working on a computer and you're removing screws, is it okay to use a little magnetic dish to put them in while you're working on them, or does that interfere with the screws when you put them back in as far as, you know, magnetic fields go and all?
I tend to use a plastic cup, actually, for that reason, because you don't want magnetic screws being screwed into your magnet-sensitive hard drive.
Yep, that's why I was asking.
Yep, that's true. They're like the doctors that have left surgical tools in people. Not very cool. Let's move on.
Okay, never use a vacuum cleaner inside a computer case or on a laptop keyboard, because the plastic parts of the vacuum cleaner can build up the static electricity and discharge to the components. And there you go. You've fried parts of your laptop or computer.
I actually have a funny story about somebody who did use a vacuum cleaner on their laptop keyboard. I won't name them, but basically they got the Dyson and they fired it up and they managed to suck the buttons off their touchpad.
Oh, nice! Okay, any questions on all of those do's and don'ts of computer tool use? Because I have some more safety procedures if nobody has any questions.
Okay, we'll catch your question when the next half of it comes through.
No, that's really not the greatest idea to use.
No, you shouldn't be using a vacuum cleaner on your computer components. Unless, of course, you are willing to take the risks associated. I actually do use a small handheld vacuum cleaner for pulling stuff out of keyboards in really bad cases, but generally I use a soft brush because it's safer. But you basically have to weigh up the cost of the keyboard, and if you don't mind killing your keyboard, go ahead and use the vacuum cleaner on it. It is your stuff, after all. Just don't do it on anybody else's.
I've heard that you can put a keyboard in a dishwasher and clean it thoroughly. As long as you let it dry thoroughly before you connect it back up.
Yep, top rack of the dishwasher on the rinse cycle will do it. However, you must let it dry. If you power up the keyboard and it still has water in it, bye-bye keyboard.
You can also put it in a bathtub and let it soak for a little while and then take it out and let it dry for days and days and days. I would probably not do that with a very expensive keyboard. I would probably not do it to somebody else's keyboard. But I've done it to mine and it works beautifully.
The best way to do it is actually to use distilled water. So you get a bottle of distilled water and pour that onto it, because that'll be, otherwise you could actually end up with chlorine and residue and stuff out of the water that comes out of your tap, and that's not cool.
Same water that I clean my LPs with.
That's the one.
Okay, we have some more things that you should really do when working with computers. That's a good way to ruin a keyboard.
No. Some of the keys are actually designed to come off. You can actually take the key tops off. But if you break the retaining clips as you take them off, you'll never get them back on again. You really got to weigh up, guys, how expensive is this keyboard? If you've got a $10 keyboard, why don't you just go buy another $10 keyboard in about 2 years? How good is it? Is money really that tight that you've got to keep the same keyboard for 4 years? And if it is, then I'd suggest you do the research into how to properly clean keyboards and how to remove the keys without breaking the retaining clips. Because you can get the keys off a keyboard, but not all keyboards have removable keys.
That's why I said it's a very easy way to, ruin a keyboard. Because if it's me or somebody who is a little bit less adept with their hands, you have a very good shot at breaking those retaining clips. Okay, now we're going to go on to some more safety ideas for using or for repairing a computer. First of all, girls or guys, remove all of your jewelry. Probably not the best idea to wear rings or bracelets inside a computer, because they can snag on components and you can hurt the components or you or your jewelry. So just not such a good idea.
Possibly your magnetic hematite ring is not a good idea when working on hard drives.
No, no, I wouldn't be wearing that one. Okay, very important. Always unplug the power cord before removing or reinstalling any electrical components or circuit boards, or when performing maintenance on electrical equipment. Very, very, very important. We do not want to get electrocuted. This goes with that. Do not touch any exposed circuit with power applied, because we do not want to get electrocuted. Only have the power applied when taking voltage measurements. Insert test probes with one hand only. Don't insert them with both hands, because you could get electrocuted. Do not leave any objects loose on equipment, such as screws, nuts, or washers. These items can fall into the equipment, so make sure to keep your screws, nuts, and bolts very tight, or as tight as you can, so that they don't come loose and rattle around inside of your computer. Before using, before replacing anything, I think, really, that says before replacing processors, always make sure to touch the outside of a piece of metal equipment and use an anti-static wrist strap, and this will keep you from having ESD damage to your components or yourself getting actually electrocuted.
Can I just butt in very, very quickly? I've just had the pleasure of meeting the person in charge of Asia Pacific training with Cisco. That's Sandy. And I've also met another lady who would be very, very interesting seeing Academy set up in both Sydney and Melbourne. So I've been doing a lot of really positive networking here. But I'll fill everybody in when I'm back home, but I'm signing off now. But it's been a very, very well worth excursion out to Box Hill.
Good for you. That's awesome. I just wanted to let you know that we had finished Module 1 and we are now working on Module 2. So we've got that going for us.
Oh, very good. Well, I've just been it's a bit quiet, but there's been a lot of people who've just heard the tail end of your lecture, so that's good.
Perfect. Well, we'll talk to you when you get home. Have a safe trip. Okay, let's start again, shall we? Okay, yeah, I just had to check my chat window because I wasn't sure who had written that at me. Okay, so let's go back to this last bullet point. Before handling or replacing any kind of components, you should always touch the outside metal of the equipment or case and use an anti-static wrist strap that is connected to the chassis to be properly grounded. Now, we always touch the non-painted metal part of the case to ground ourselves, and we can hook the alligator clip of an anti-static wrist strap to our computer, and you put the other end around your wrist and off you go. They kind of look like the the point between your actual base of your telephone and the receiver. That's kind of what the cord on an anti-static wrist strap looks like, kind of the spirally stretchy cord. So you've got a lot of freedom of movement. You've got to make sure the equipment is grounded prior to removing the case, and this reduces the likelihood of ESD damage. Do not troubleshoot electric equipment without having proper documentation, because if we don't know what we're doing, we're in very big danger of getting hurt. Never solder any connections with the power on, of course. After soldering, look for possible solder splashes and cold solder joints or damages to insulation. I don't know how many of us are actually going to be soldering, so I don't know how much of this actually really applies. Always maintain a clean and safe work area. Don't be sloppy. Leave your tools where you can find them, especially as blind people. Keep very organized. use plastic cup or tray or something to put your screws in. Don't leave them all over because they're very easy to knock around and you don't want to be climbing around on the floor looking for lost screws, nuts, bolts, or other little parts. Make sure not to rush through procedures. Take your time. There's no reason to rush. You will have plenty of time to do what you're doing, and if you rush, you're just going to make more work for yourself and possibly damage components. Make sure you know what you're doing. If you're not sure about what you're doing, ask for help. It's okay to ask for help if you don't know what you're doing. It's better than messing it up and then having to be like, oh no, what did I do? Ask for help. Ask an instructor. Ask, look it up online. It's okay to say, I don't know what I'm doing, so I can't do this right now. I'll get back to it later, and find out exactly what you're supposed to be doing. Don't touch anything if you have any doubts about how you are supposed to do it. Make sure that you know what you're doing before you get into the computer case, and at any point, if you don't know what you're doing, stop. It's better safe than sorry. Make sure that you know where your fire extinguishers are. We use a Class C fire extinguisher for putting out electrical fires, such as ones that might be caused by computers. Make sure you know where that is. Make sure you know where a first aid kit is, if necessary, when you're working on a computer somewhere. Make sure you know the way out of a building if there was to be a fire. If there is ever a fire, your first priority is to get out. Get out, then call for help. Don't worry about anything else. Get yourself out of there. Don't try to be a hero. Just go. If you can, grab the fire extinguisher. But just get out of there. And then call for emergency services and get help. That means you do need to know the emergency services phone numbers. Make sure you have them. In America, it's 911. I don't know if anyone else knows any of the emergency phone numbers for other countries.
It's 000 in Australia.
Oh, right on. Good to know.
I always used to laugh at that because if it was 000, you could be like dialing these zeros on the rotary phone while the bloke was sort of running up to you on the with a knife waiting for the dial to spin back round as you dial the zeros. But it's all right, we've all got touch-tone phones now, so it's all good.
Wear appropriate clothing when working with computers. Closed-toed shoes, long pants, long shirt, if you're soldering or working with anything dangerous. This helps so that you don't get hot soldering stuff on your clothes or on yourself. You get it on your clothes, and that's a lot better. I'm just scrolling through notes, so if anyone has any questions, feel free to ask.
Just a comment, blind people can solder. It's a special tool that holds the end of the solder roll at the tip. So you turn the roll with your thumb while you're pointing the, I don't know how, but what quality the work would be, but it can be done.
Yeah, Will Taylor solders.
Pardon me?
A guy who studied our course 2007, Will Taylor. He does soldering. He lurks on the discuss lists and stuff. He doesn't use one of those special tools. He just does it himself, but he does use a solder station to manage the solder and that sort of thing. Not recommended, but if you're good enough to be able to do it, then that's good. We don't condone the behaviour in the course, but yes, it is possible. We won't be held responsible for burnt fingers. And you do burn them for the first couple of weeks.
I know.
An assignment we usually set people is find out about the fire extinguisher classifications in your country. We'd like all students to find out what sort of fire extinguishers you can get and what they're used for and what sort of classifications they are. That's usually an assignment we set each year for this chapter.
I do remember that, but they went over all of the American ones, and I just went over the Class C standards. So yes, everybody... we have quite a few U.S. students. Make sure to find that out for next week, and we will try and remember to talk about that, and we'll see what we find out. And Jenny, if you can get the Australian ones, that'd be really cool.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, a couple of suggestions for your keeping your work area clean. Keep food and drinks out of your workspace. When you're taking apart a computer, it's not the best idea to have food and drinks around. You don't want that inside of your computer case. Now, I know that some of us do eat in front of our desks. You're not really supposed to do that, just so you know. But I'm just as guilty as anyone else.
Here he is.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Keep your workspace clean and free of clutter. Don't throw papers all over it. If you get a post-it note inside of your computer, that's really bad. Or who knows what else? Roll a tape. Just keep everything in its place when working with computers. Does anyone remember how we lift heavy objects?
With our
squat
leg.
Down and lift with your leg.
That is correct. As I said, never fight a fire that is out of control or not contained. Get out of there, then call for help. Always have a planned fire escape route before beginning any work. Get out of the building quickly. Contact emergency services for help. And that's what we do in a case of a fire. So have any of you ever experienced zapping each other by touching somebody else and you get that little shock? I'm sure we all have. That is what it feels like.
Yeah, okay. What you do is you actually get a couple of bits of wire and a 9-volt battery, and then when somebody winds their feet up on the carpet, you belt them with a 9-volt battery. Sorry, I'd just like to say that I don't recommend you do that, but it was pretty funny.
That's like 10,000 volts of ESD. Remember, 30 can hurt your computers. So always, if you can, work with your computers on an EST.
Matt?
Yeah.
Okie dokies. And next we're going to talk about the impact of stuff on the environment. And I'm just saying that to give Grace a little bit more time to reposition her braille display. As in the Christopher we know. Yeah, tell him to go away. You're in lecture.
No, not that one. The other one.
Oh, okay. Tell him we're in lecture.
Yeah, that's what I was planning on doing because he's in this class and I wasn't sure if he was wanting to come.
Okay, all right, deal with him and I'll do the next section. Okay, question. Can computers and their components be harmful to the environment? Can anybody tell me? Yes, no?
Yes.
Yes.
And can somebody tell me why they might be harmful to the environment?
The old CRT monitors had lead.
They do. The old CRT monitors have lead.
And they don't break down in the environment. If they're in landfill, they stay there for hundreds, thousands of years.
That's correct. Also, computers contain heavy metals such as gold, and the only way of melting down gold is a solution of boiling aqua regia, which is 3 parts nitric, 1 part sulfuric. Don't let that get on the carpet, people. Very nasty stuff. Or you, yes, it burns holes in you too. They also contain a lot of heavy metals such as lead, gallium. I think there were cases where they had arsenic in some of the things. So they actually do contain a high amount of stuff that is quite harmful to the environment. There is what we call a Material Safety Data Sheet, or MSDS, and they actually summarise the impact of a particular component or a particular substance on the environment. And often you can actually get those Material Safety Data Sheets from the manufacturer of whatever it is. So, for example, I had the one for Shellite, and it tells you interesting things such as the flash point, the ignition temperature, the toxicity, what you're to do if you ingest it, all of those sorts of important things if bad things do happen with these potentially hazardous and poisonous materials.
It also will tell you how to dispose of them properly. And the local environmental regulations.
What are we doing with Christopher? Is his ventrilo broken?
No, he's coming. He just booted up and he'll be on his way shortly.
No workers.
But now I am back. Sorry about that. I just figured I should probably talk to one of our students.
Yes, that is correct.
What?
Yeah, in dry environment. It's okay. Marcus's spelling is
gotcha.
You can actually have increased risk of electrostatic discharge in dry environments. So low humidity, you can get a lot more electrostatic discharge.
I have returned, folks.
Yeah, W. Belio.
Ah, right on. Are there any questions? Is anything unclear about anything we've gone through so far? Okay, I guess we can go on to how to dispose of different computer components. Monitors or CRTs, dispose with in compliance with environmental regulations. In America, that usually means you're taking it down to a computer disposal center or recycling it. We've got toner kits, cartridges, and developers. Dispose of properly or recycle. That means you're probably going to want to take it to your nearest Walgreens store in America, where they will take care of it for you. And if you buy one of their toner cartridges, you don't throw them out.
In Australia, we actually have a mob called Planet Ark, and they will actually give you a small amount of money back for recycled toner cartridges.
Oh, okay, I think there are programs that'll do that for you too here. I just don't know of which ones.
Do not tip them down the drain.
No, that's a really bad idea. That is so bad in our sewer system. You don't want to drink that. Don't pour anything down the drain that you yourself would not want to drink, because it's going into your water supply, guys.
That's why I don't pour alcohol down the drain.
Chemical solvents and aerosol cans, contact the local sanitation company to dispose of them. Never dump them down a sink or drain, because, as I said, do you want to drink that? You can also look at the material safety data sheet, and that may tell you how to dispose of the solvent or aerosol. Also, batteries, if it's a regular AA battery or AAA battery that you buy at the store, you can throw them out in America, that's fine. If it's a computer battery, you're going to want to take it down to your local computer recycling center to get it disposed of properly.
If you can. Now, in Australia, this is an interesting case in point, there is one recycling day per year. Isn't that great? So you've got to find out when that day is, which isn't announced, and then take all of your stuff down, and then they decide whether they're going to take it or not. And if they're not going to take it, you're stuck with it. It's really badly organized over here.
So then what do you do with it?
Unofficially, you drop it in the bin and it goes away in the garbage truck.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we've got some computer recycling centers, and you can also, if you look hard enough, there's computer recycling days where they'll go and take it free for free. Like, people at the local radio station will be out there, "We're taking old computer parts to recycle them. Come down and drop your stuff off."
I think we do phone recycling here. Some phone shops have bins and that, where you can recycle your phones and that sort of gear.
Hey, there's Christopher.
Hello, hi, Christopher. There. Nice to see you.
Good morning, all.
And your microphone even works. Right, that's 10 extra marks on his initial mark, I think.
Oh, for sure. Good for you.
Please forgive the 60 hertz on that.
No, that's all right. Better late than never. The lecture started an hour and a half ago, but not a trauma. We're glad to have you along.
Okay, we're going to talk about tools and documentation, if that's okay with everybody, and if nobody has any questions on how to dispose properly of products that are no longer being used when it pertains to computers. Okay.
Yes, there is always the attic, or the basement.
Yeah, I have every computer I bought since 1981 right above me in the attic.
I want to see your attic. That would be so cool.
In Australia, it's a shed. We don't tend to have attics or basements.
All right, we're going to talk a little bit about documentation. Documentation is very important. Tech technician should document repairs or problems so they can be used later on. You can think you'll remember it all you want. You might remember your first one, or five, or ten, but eventually they all blur and they become the same, trust me, I know. So documenting all of your computer repairs and problems is a great way to keep track and keep a journal and remember what solutions you used and what worked and what didn't. The documentation helps in creating a knowledge base and helps technicians work more effectively, because then you don't have to go and find a solution to a problem you've already solved.
It also, I was just going to point out that 30% of information is retrieved by reading. Documenting something is a very good way of reinforcing the things you did, because if you have to document it, it makes you think about it again. You make your own logs, and in fact, there's a bloke who's a bit of a trekker. He actually calls them the captain's logs, and they actually log what happens to his file servers and stuff. I don't know whether he converts all of the regular dates into star dates, but he does actually log all the things that happens with the hardware and the software on servers so that he can look back and track recurring problems and stuff.
I think there is actually software out there that can help you make logs. I don't know exactly which software, but if you wanted to, you could probably Google us it and let us know next week.
There is a whole stack of free stuff, actually. Free help desk logging and recording software, also customer relation managers, and also financial managing, say, for example, Compierge, CRM. Have a look around on SourceForge. You'll be surprised what's out there. A whole lot of web-based stuff that you can use and that is actually free. I have no idea how you spell Compierge, but it's in the top 10 projects. SourceForge, SourceForge. It's got thousands of open source products. And in fact, while we're plugging open source products, would I just like to point out that everybody be very happy, we now have the author of Quitter signed in. If you've used Twitter at all, you'll probably have used Quitter. And if you're going to use Twitter, you probably will use Quitter. He's the author of Quitter. So there you go. There's your time in the sun. Let's move on.
Yeah, I've got to say, Quitter is pretty awesome.
And you can get it by going to www.quitter-client.net. So there we go, that's about as advertisement as we can get. So do check that out if you're signed up on Twitter. It's an excellent, accessible Twitter client called Quitter. Spelt Q-W-I-T-T-E-R. I should probably mention that.
Yeah, now people can find it. Okay, we are very quickly going to go over some tools. We're going to go over the anti-static tools. We've got an anti-static wrist strap, and as I said, you are going to clip the alligator clip to the computer. You're going to tie that little wrist strap around your wrist. Make sure it's on a non-painted, smooth metal part of the case. You're going to be able to tell the painted parts because they're a little bit rougher usually. And that will allow you to keep yourself grounded while you work with the computer. If it comes unclipped, just reach up and clip it back on. Make sure you're clipped in so you have no problems with, problems with static. You've also got an anti-static mat. Put your computer onto the anti-static mat. You can use a grounding point on the case. It's got the same kind of alligator clip as the anti-static wrist strap, but it's a big old mat that your computer and your computer components can sit on, and you just clip it to that, and off you go. If you use both of those, you're doing really well.
Probably also pays to ground your anti-static mat, just thought I'd mention that. If you don't ground your anti-static mat, it's not much good.
Yep. We also can keep our components in anti-static bags. This keeps them safe. If you can, please don't put your components on an anti-static bag. Put them into an anti-static bag, as I mentioned before. That's going to keep them safe. And no, a plastic bag does not do the trick.
Can you buy the anti-static bags?
Yes, you can. Dick Smith's has them in different sizes. J-Car also has them, and J-Car tend to be a bit cheaper than Dick Smith's.
Okay, now we're going to go on to our hand tools, unless somebody has questions about the anti-static tools. Okay. Go ahead.
I was just testing my output. Chris said my level was slightly lower than yours, so I was just checking that. We get that. We just sort of deal. I'll be normalizing this up to minus 10 dB when we're finished.
Okay, we're going to go over hand tools. Please make sure to use the correct hand tool. Don't use a Phillips head screwdriver in a flat screw. You're going to strip the heads, as Carrie said already. So, we've got a flathead screwdriver. This is used for the slotted screws, the ones with the straight line in them, not the star ones. The star ones are our Phillips head screwdrivers. We've got our Torx screwdrivers and our hex screwdrivers. They're used for less common types of screws and bolts. We've got needle nose pliers to try to pick up screws and things inside of our case. We've got wire cutters. That's used to cut wires, of course. Tweezers to pick up really small screws. Tweezers or a part retriever will do that. And a flashlight if you have some vision.
And you can get some really good ones that don't require batteries. So, for example, I've got some dynamo-powered ones, so you turn them off and wind the dynamo handle and it charges them up, and then you can use them, because sighted people always want to use the torch, and the batteries are flat, so that nullifies that problem. I've got a whole different collection of dynamo-powered flashlights that Grace won't really care about, but she'll be able to see when she comes over on Saturday.
We've also got the shake flashlights, and you just shake them and they light up. It's great. Apparently those are really cool, and I see them sold all the time. Yeah,
yeah, apparently
they're in commercials at like 2 in the morning. Alright, I'll have to test that out.
Yeah, but now I've got the shaker torch as well. They're not really that good because you don't actually charge up the super cap very much, but they are enough for a very low level of illumination. The wind-up ones are better.
The shaker ones that I have use an LED that's pretty bright.
Yeah, some of them do. I think it depends on how much you pay for your shaky torch as to how good they are. But yeah, basically they've got a permanent magnet that slides backwards and forwards in a coil, and then that induces a current into the coil, and then I'd say they actually have a diode to rectify the current, and then that just gets shoveled into the super cap.
Okay, I'm just getting a message about the magnetic screwdrivers being a godsend, especially for blinks who drop screws. We went over that and why you probably shouldn't use them. Of course you can, but in the test, if they ask you if you should use magnetic tools, the answer is no.
I would just like to say that I have never managed to trash a hard drive with a magnet, and believe me, I've tried with some very powerful permanent magnets and wiping them all over them, and I've never managed to kill them.
Nor have I, and I've certainly tried as well. With quite some power.
Now, don't do that to anybody else's hard drive. Make sure they're your hard drives you're trying them on, of course. But yeah, very difficult to destroy a hard disk with a magnet. I know they say you shouldn't be able to do it. I have seen floppy disks destroyed with X-rays when they used to use high-powered X-rays. But they've wound the power back, so it's not so bad now. Now, I'd just like to point out here that there are times when our reality will differ from what the notes say. That is pretty standard. In the test, you will answer what the notes tell you, and in real life, it is up to you to make your assertion as to whether our reality is something that you want to follow.
Oh, by the way, Christopher, if you want to... you use Ventrilo. I was going to say, if you want to pop up in your chat window, that's fine. We do make comments in chat, and that is all good.
Yeah, just the private chat is good if you're only saying something to me, but it does actually shift the focus, and some of our students panic if their focus shifts. Not me or Grace, but some of the more timid ones get frightened when their focus shifts and they don't expect it. And Jenny doesn't get freaked out either. Isn't that good?
Okay, any more on the hardware tools?
That's not relevant, Marcus, I'm sorry. If you are going for an MRI, they'll certainly tell you that you don't have any metal on you. That's because they are using magnets to scan you, but I don't think we'll be using MRI scanners in our diagnostic work. We're not doing advanced hard disk recovery.
All right, we're going on to cleaning tools. You can use a soft cloth to wipe off the back of your computer area. You can use compressed air to clean off your keyboard or dust the inside of your computer. Again, probably don't use a vacuum even though it's anti-static, because the plastic parts can get static and you can destroy components. You use cable ties to tie up excess bits in your computer. Sometimes you'll have longer cords and you'll want to tie them up. You use parts organizer, or as Carrie calls it, a plastic cup to put your screws in.
I actually use, instead of cable ties, I've actually found that the we've got a local hardware chain called Bunnings, but you can actually get this green plastic-coated wire that's used for tying plants to bushes, and I actually get a couple of reels of that, and I actually use that because that way you can snip it off to the length you want and then tie the things up without having to buy those expensive pull-through cable ties. But, you know, just depends on what you're into. But, yeah, that works for me.
And you can use them more than once.
That's right. Although there are actually reusable cable ties with a little release thing that you can sort of press with your finger and it'll actually release them, but they tend to be more expensive than anybody wants to spend out on.
All right. We've got diagnostic tools. We've got the multimeter that tests our power, a loopback adapter, and disk management tools such as defragmenters, and those are the cable ties. Defragmenter and disk checking. You've got your F-disk that will create and delete partitions on a hard drive.
Yes, you're right, actually. What I would recommend, though, is that is a last-ditch effort. If you've tried everything else, yes, put the drive in the freezer and then power it up and rip all the data off as fast as you can before the drive warms up again. There are actually cases where people do run fans on hard disks, or they put them in the freezer, or they put them in a Ziploc bag to keep the moisture off them and drop them in the freezer. So yeah, you can actually revive dead hard drives by putting them in the freezer, but that is a last-ditch effort. First rule of data recovery, always exhaust all of the reversible acts first. So do the things like read-only scans, read-only tests, those sorts of things. Only start your potentially destructive tests once you have exhausted all of the safe ones, because there's no going back once you've put it in the freezer. But if you're at that point, then obviously there isn't any going back, so it's all good.
Okay, just going back to some of these tools. Format prepares a hard disk to store information. Scan disk or check disk checks the disk for errors and bad files. And defrag, as I said, optimizes space on a hard drive to allow faster access to programs and data. Disk cleanup clears space on the hard drive by searching for files that can be deleted, such as our internet history and all of that stuff, and the temporary internet files and any kind of setup or log files.
And CCleaner does a fair bit better job than disk cleanup, so you might want to look at www.ccleaner.com, and we will be compiling a list of useful software and links at some point that will go up on the website that you can all look on. I'd also just like to point out that if any of the software that we recommend hoses your computer, we are terribly sorry. We will not be held responsible in no way, etc., etc. Disclaim, disclaim, disclaim. So just be aware of that. If you install the newest version of, say, JK Defrag and it blitzes your hard disk, well, you had backups, so don't worry about it. If you don't have backups, now would be a good time to make them or find out how to make them.
Backups are really important, especially for our coursework, because if you lose them, you may have to do it over again if we don't have a copy. And
our official policy is we do not keep copies of students' work. We do not keep copies of students' work. If we happen to have one, you're very, very lucky. But do back up your own lab work, please.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. We usually don't. So do back it all up and back up all the important things on your hard drive, because you never know when it's going to decide to crash.
What about this skills assessment test that we took? Do you guys get the results of that, or should I have printed out the results? We need to keep track of that kind of stuff?
Okay.
No, we get all of the results in the gradebook, and we can see them all, and you do not have to keep track of them or send them to us. Only your worksheets and labs. Your tests, we have.
Okay. Yep, that's very true. If you're repairing a client system with an alternative operating system, you will be using other tools such as FSCK or file system check. If you're using XFS file systems, you could use XFS underline FSR to reorganize the file system stuff. And you can also be using other handy-dandy tools. I would just like to advertise GRML, an excellent talking Linux distribution that you can boot people's computers up with. And you can actually use various utilities on there to check the consistency of various file systems. And because it talks, you can do it all from the shell or the command line interface, and it gives you another handy tool in your arsenal of weapons for combating spyware and viruses and trojans and corrupted hard drives and stuff. Yes, NTFS does have, GRML does have NTFS 3G installed, so you have full read-write support of NTFS file systems, and you can share them across the network with Samba if you know what you're doing.
Is the first letter Juliet or George?
George or Golf. Golf Romeo Mike Lima, GRML.
Roger.
Good morning, Jackie. Or evening, it is evening still. One more day.
Who's counting?
Good evening, y'all.
Okay, we're going to very quickly go over these software tools because we're going to go over them in depth in other chapters. We have the Windows XP Security Center. We have antivirus. We have spyware. And we have firewall. You can read your notes for more information on those, and we will be going over them in a later chapter.
I usually turn off the Security Center because I get sick and tired of those balloons that tell me that there's no firewall installed. I know. I turned it off. So you go into services.
Yeah, me too.
You go into services and you stop the Security Center. Now, I'd just like to point out you take full responsibility for doing that, but yet you go into services, which is right-click on My Computer, Manage, down to the bottom, Services, and stop Security Center.
Makes life a lot better for me since I use a firewall on my router. Okay, we are going to talk. Go ahead.
I was going to say, anybody got any comments on that section? Because we're just about to move on to something else. All right, go for it. Unless you want to stop here, because we are at 10:45. It's up to you. Do you want to keep going on for another 10 minutes or so?
I think we do probably want to stop and take questions and wrap up. I think there's a little left of this lecture, so I will finish it up next week, probably before Elise moves on to Module 3.